The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, welcome back. So during the break, I spoke briefly with Lydia, and she shared with me a little insight that she had, which then I kind of tweaked, and we both were like so happy with this little metaphor simile that we came up together. So I'm going to share it with you. I think Lydia is upstairs in the finance office. Otherwise, I'd ask her to do it. She said that she had just received an email, if I understood correctly, from Abhaya Giri that talked about how sila, ethics, morality, virtue, and samadhi, you know, concentration, collectedness, meditation, are two pillars of practice. And in fact, that according to Abhaya Giri, that you could imagine a ladder in which one of the things, the poles is sila, virtue, morality, and the other one is samadhi, meditation, collectedness. And there's these different rungs. And part of practice is to not let go. To maybe you move your hand, but you have this hand here, or then you pick up and you put this other hand here. So maybe we could think of resolve and determination as a way of just staying on this ladder, and you let go and maybe hold on again as a way of is using wisdom. Sometimes that's what's needed, right? Sometimes we need some doggedness, determination, and sometimes we need some relaxation and openness. But that sila and samadhi can be the pillars on the side. I really liked that. I thought, you know, it's kind of something that visceral and that we can imagine, like moving up a ladder. It gives this idea that we're going somewhere. I'm not sure. And then Rob also shared with me an idea that came to him. Would you like to share that, Rob?
I was thinking about the ideas of determination and how they... It really reflects on agency to me, which is our ability to act in the world. And what that opened up was just a little bit of a different view on what it is about equanimity. Equanimity, therefore, has this dynamic component to it, a component of action. And it's more like, I was saying, of standing and always maintaining our balance. We're always moving a little bit, but we come back to the center to stay standing. And so I hadn't really appreciated that particular aspect of equanimity before. And you shared something else with that.
Yeah, so this relationship between resolve and equanimity, if we could think of like standing in the center, like standing balanced, like not getting pushed around. Aditana, tana means standing. And adi is like what's intensifier, so like to really stand. So in the same way, sometimes equanimity, tetra, majja, tata, sometimes is like being in the middle. Majja means middle. It's being in the middle. So standing and in the middle, they both have this quality of kind of being centered. So it's just flesh out our understanding and our thinking about resolve and determination. So we're going to do a short guided meditation. It's not going to be very long, but just as a way to get settled and to kind of maybe build on an idea that's already been floating around here in the room, but we'll build on it a little bit. So for this meditation, maybe this won't be any surprise, I'm going to ask for you to choose an object of focus. For many of us, that object of focus is the sensations of breathing. So we'll just choose what you're going to pay attention to, what you're going to focus on. And then when you find that your mind has wandered off, you just very gently come back to your object that very well may be breathing. It's not complicated. With our meditation, we often resolve to stay on our object for the meditation period. For this meditation session, see if you can sense, maybe tune in, what does it feel like? What is this experience of when you wake up from having been lost in thought, or for whatever reason, no longer paying attention to your object? What does it feel like to return to the object? What is that experience of coming back? As you're noticing what it's like to return to the object, you might notice like how much energy or effort is involved. What is the mental state like in that brief moment when you're returning? While still doing the same meditation, staying on your object, now pay special attention to what are the types of things that pull you away. the certain experiences or certain ideas, without getting lost in any of the particulars, more just what are the types, what are the, like the class of things in a general way that pulls you away. And now maybe you can notice, is it getting easier to stay with the object as this meditation period progresses? If you can briefly reflect, how was it at the very beginning of this meditation period? Is it getting more difficult? Is it staying the same? Maybe you're not sure, you can't remember how the beginning was. But if you can, do you have a sense? So of course, like, why do we need resolve? Because just like Taylor pointed out earlier, just like in our meditation practice, right? We just kind of come back to the object in meditation. the object may change, what we're meditating about, but the practice of meditation is so much about coming back in a kind-hearted way, if we can, in a way that doesn't feel effortful and that we're striving and, you know, trying really hard to make it happen. Because that's not sustainable for very long. You can't do it for a while. And sometimes that is needed, but it's not, can't be the default, that it's the only way in which we keep on coming back to the object. So in some ways, our meditation practice is very much like our bigger life practice. Right, and we see this a lot in the Buddhist teachings, this expression like scale and variability. It's like what you see at the small scale, kind of the minutiae, that same pattern you see in bigger things in your life. And we see this, of course, like in meditation practice, we see how we have this propensities for particular things, or we get thrown off by particular things. What we see in meditation, come to find out, we see is also in our larger life, right? And what supports our meditation practice supports our larger life too. So in the same way, resolve can be like our meditation practice, just this kind of continuously coming back. And I I was listening to a Dharma talk that somebody said something that I thought was kind of interesting. They were describing sending rockets into space to hook up with the International Space Station, you know, to bring whatever it is they bring to the space station. And of course, right, these are very sophisticated navigation systems and rocket systems, right? We can imagine maybe some of the most sophisticated we have that the human beings have created. And they were saying that 98% of the time, the vast majority of the time, the rocket is off course. This is, for me, it was like encouraging, right? So it's off just a little bit, and then it corrects, and then maybe it overcorrects, and then it comes back, and then it comes back, you know. So it's not like we're spot on, holding on, exactly in the middle, doing only this thing all the time. It's like, no, we're finding our way. Just like with meditation, we're not always on the object, let's be honest. It's not so common that we're just smack on. It does happen, but it's usually in a retreat setting, or, you know, we have all the right conditions. So in the same way, resolve can be about not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. That's like, you know, okay. Actually, I heard somebody told me this just yesterday. I thought this was very interesting. She was saying that it would be like giving up just because you had a little setback or things weren't going the way that you wanted. Would be like if you were driving down the road and one of you got a flat tire. This is a bummer. This is a big deal, right? It's certainly inconvenient, uncomfortable. Nobody wants this. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. It can be scary. But she said, sometimes we get out of the car and then go puncture the other three tires. Right? We just kind of like abandon everything. Like, oh, this is terrible. Instead of, you know, just calling AAA or, you know, doing what needs to be done to just get back on the way. Get back on the direction we're going. So in the same way, resolve can be like that. It can be like not puncturing the other tires. And maybe we don't immediately call AAA, or maybe we don't even really know what to do. Maybe we panic. Maybe we, I don't know, we can have a whole range of emotions. Maybe we get afraid, confused. But we can still come back like, okay, I guess here I am. Maybe somebody pulls over and helps us. Maybe we call, we ask for help. And all these ways, kind of resolve is just this, okay, I'm not going to abandon my car here. I'm not going to abandon where I was going, even though I came up with some difficulty. So we need resolve in all areas of our life, including our spiritual practice. which we would be mistaken if we think that in order for a spiritual practice, all we have to do is be nice and not harm anybody. Sometimes it takes some real determination. And sometimes it takes just simple, kind of like manual labor, right? It's not glamorous. It's not sexy. It's not, you don't hear a lot of Dharma talks about just a little bit, is it drudgery? I don't know what the word is, but just to simply come back. Just simply come back. Without making it into a big problem, but just simply come back. Doesn't have to be complicated, but so much of our practice is about this. This really simple consistency. And I think it's true for all of our lives, right? Right now I'm talking about spiritual practice. It doesn't matter what you want to do in your life. It's the same, right? It's just this kind of small, tiny, lots and lots of tiny, small things. And then, of course, with our spiritual practice, our meditation practice. Yeah, this would be inconvenient if I lost my voice. We'll see if we can work with this. Because the truth is, we do find things, whatever we set our intentions on, our aspirations on, sometimes it's inconvenient. Sometimes it's uncomfortable. Sometimes there are other fun things to do, more fun things to do, funner things to do. Sometimes it may not be what everyone else is doing. So we can use some resolve, some commitment, determination to kind of stay with it. Maybe I should say also that sometimes it's difficult. I just want to honor that sometimes there's just real difficulties are with meditation practice especially and special with spiritual practice in general. We can just come up with difficulties. We can see things about the world that we didn't quite understand anymore that make us really uncomfortable. We can see things about ourselves that makes us uncomfortable, that are difficult, that we wish weren't that way. We can sometimes, we've been talking about truth, but sometimes seeing the truth of things, it's not easy, right? And then there can be kind of a hesitation to stay with it when these things arise. And they will arise. That's kind of part of what spiritual practice is. It's about creating the conditions for all these things to come up. Some of it will be pleasant and some of it won't be pleasant. So I'd like us to explore a little bit, like what are some of these hindrances? What are some of the things that make it difficult? What are some of the things that get in the way of our determination once we've kind of like set our mind that we want to go a particular direction? What are the things that, that make it difficult? So I'm going to set this up as, we'll get into small groups to talk about this, and I'll set it up that it'll be a two-part question. So I'll give you guys a first question, let you talk, and then I'll give you the second question. And unlike what we did earlier, where one person talks for a while and then another person talks for a while, we'll do kind of like more of this spiral method, where one person says something. It can be very simple, not a whole lot. It can be one word, it can be one sentence, but, you know, not a whole lot. And then it goes around to the next person, and they say something. And then it goes around to the next person, they say something. Maybe the fourth person say something. And maybe by the time it's come back around to you, you've thought of something different. You're influenced by what you heard the other people say, and maybe you have a different idea. So in this way, you can share your own experiences, your own ideas, but you're also, as a group, you're kind of creating something, right? Because you're influencing each other. So in this way, you'll just go around and around the circle, just each person saying something very short. This isn't a time to give advice to each other. This isn't a time to instruct each other. It's just a time to kind of share, like, your understanding, your exploration of the question. So I'll tell you the first question, and then you'll do the spiral thing, and then I'll ring the bell, and then I'll give you the second question. For those of you who've been doing this for a while, you can imagine what the second question might be. But for the first, I'd like you to stay on, what are some of the difficulties that you've discovered? What are some of the things that get us in the way? It could be very specific, or it could be in general. It could be something like fear, or it could be something like fear of what other people are going to think, that I'm weird if I do this, right? So you can do whatever comes up for you. And let's get into groups of five. So if you want to find yourselves into a groups of five, and you can start with that question, like, so we can report back. Oh, I guess there's still one group up there. There it goes. I'll just offer an observation. That was quite something. When you're talking about the difficulties, there was energy in conversation. Talk about how to work with the difficulties, and that kind of energy went out. And I don't know if that was your experience, but that was my experience on the outside, kind of just watching. Like, it's not as easy to talk about how to be with the difficulties or work with them. But I'd love to hear, how did that go? Did you learn anything? The process of exploring, like, what are the difficulties and what are some of the ways we can work with them? And maybe you can draw from the meditation we did also earlier. But Kate, let's see, I think I've lost track of where our microphones are. Great, thank you.
Well, it struck me that right away that what we were talking about was the five hindrances. And if we had a chart up on the wall, I know my husband here would be making a list, and we'd have this across this, and then you'd have the five hindrances coming down, you know.
Because, make a little chart out of
it. Yeah, and five hindrances, for those who might not be familiar with them, are they're paired. Two pairs, and then one on its own, and it's greed or desire, hate, aversion, agitation and worry, sort of sloth and torpor, and then doubt. And doubt can be huge in this area. Doubt it's going to do any good, doubt I can do it, all those kinds of things.
Yeah. Great. Thank you, Kate. One of those other lists comes in here, right? Five hindrances: sensual desire, aversion, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor, doubt. Right? We see them playing out in our meditation practice. We see them playing out in our lives. And they kind of get in the way with resolve. But those may be underlying, but there may be more kind of like practical or daily life expressions of these two. Did you guys discover some of those, or Henrika?
Well, essentially for me, it's not being where I am. So, and finding all the different ways to extricate myself from where I am by thinking or planning or fantasizing or whatever, and the underlying is like the anxiety that's there. So the helpful thing to do for me is essentially connect to my body and acknowledge how I feel and what's going on, and then cry if I need to, or whatever comes up, let it be. And then it opens up, and I feel this relief, this calm, this acceptance of nothing's resolved, of course, but I am better. So.
Yeah, and maybe turning towards the truth of the moment, right?
Has
this helps.
Exactly.
Great. Thank you, Henrika. Judy?
Well, I always enjoy the commonality in the group, and it was very enriching in this group that we just had, hearing people say things that I then remember, oh, yes, and also building on what someone has said. So I enjoyed the style of the discussion. It was very rich.
Great, thank you. Yeah, it's nice to, right? We all have wisdom that we can share and create something together. Thank you, Judy.
Something that came up in our group that several people mentioned in terms of what helps us is community and accountability. And it really reflected on how much we need each other.
Thank you, Sandy. And that's a big part of Dharma practice days, right? It's about practicing with others and building a community. So, and it supports us in so many ways. I made that comment that seemed like the room had more energy to talk about the difficulties and less energy to talk about what is supportive. Was that true? Was that your experience? Which was easier? Which was like more obvious and jumped out, or which did you have more ideas around? Were they the same?
Yes.
Oh, they were. Okay. Many of you are shaking your head. I'm sorry, I don't know your name. Okay. Kristen.
I actually found more energy out of talking about what helps.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it was actually quite nice, and I learned a lot from talking to people. And I mean, I'll just say for myself, like, I think that mindfulness of the body is really underrated and under-discussed sometimes, and it's really helpful, I think, when things are difficult to focus on how it's manifesting in the body and kind of getting out of the thoughts about it. But a couple of people brought it up here, but in our group, someone brought up community too and the importance of community. And I just don't meditate well on my own. So I sort of knew that that was a thing for meditation, but I didn't really consider it sort of outside of meditation that I can use my personal community for support and things for which I am resolved in having difficulty. And then I think finding the right community is really important too, because there's, you know, just different strengths and weaknesses among people. So finding the right person to give you the support you're looking for is useful.
Thank you. Mindfulness of the body, community. What are some other things that can support us?
A sense of choice. If some noise comes up out there, I can just say, oh, hearing. And then the phrase that popped into my mind was, I don't have to get caught up in either desire to hear that or make a story about it. I don't have to get caught up into aversion that I'm annoyed that there's this noise outside our meditation hall. And I guess choice then really... A sense of choice means there's a sense of agency. I don't have to. And past experience can add, it can support that. Resolve can support resolve.
Absolutely.
Lead to some faith. Even if today I'm not doing well, I have had some good experience meditating.
Exactly. In some ways, resolve, it can be like a muscle that gets stronger the more that we do it. Maybe because we have positive experiences, like, oh yeah, I did find my way with this other difficult thing. I have a little story that I shared with you that I started coming to Dharma practice days and it made a big difference. One of the things that I did is I went back to school to study Buddhist studies, and I'm now a professor of Buddhist studies. And for one of my classes, I had to write this ginormous paper, and I thought, I can never do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. It was just quite something. And I got so mad that I, how dare they ask me to do this? You know, I was just like, all this is quite something. I found a way to do it. I cried. I was just like so, I can't believe like how much aversion I had to it. But I found a way to do it just one tiny little bit at a time, just a little bit at a time, asking for an extension, you know, all this kind of stuff. I found my way. And somehow just completing that made me feel like, oh, well, I wonder what else I can do now. You know, it kind of like just gave me a certain like empowerment. So in the same way, if we're able to stick to whatever it is, it doesn't have to be a big thing, but even if just having done it before makes it a little bit easier to do it again. And we learn from the past, of course, and then we can do it again and then do it again. So thank you, Kate. Yeah. Yes. And can you say your name again?
Jill.
Jill, thank you.
So I know what you meant about the energy because I felt it too, but I feel like it could be related to the fact, because it's something that's come up in both the discussions is you know, determination as opposed to effort, you know, and how, you know, to be resolved without having an overabundance of controlling or clinging effort. And what I think what was talked about in our group was kind of like the what you just said is I mean, resolve leads to this natural flow, you know, where you, as you said, you were adjusting, but you're still kind of in that flow. So I felt like our group kind of, it was kind of settled down, because when you talked about the positive aspects, you're kind of in that flow, you know,
nice.
of resolve, but the effort's coming, not just you're allowing it rather than being effortful.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Jill. So maybe I completely misinterpreted what was happening. You guys were all kind of like settled into the flow. Maybe that's nice. I think Morgan back there. Yeah. Oh. You, Lana, and then maybe Morgan. Oh, you didn't? Oh, I see. Okay, great. Yolanda. Is the microphone on? I'm not sure.
That wasn't on. Well, for me, motivation to get the things done is very important. When I feel good about myself, I feel grounded and connected, that makes me more like more motivated to focus on one thing and to get rid of all the distractions. Mm-hmm. And distractions, you know, having too many things to do is usually my problem to get one thing done.
Yeah. Right. But this, I think probably many of us have this experience. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you, Yolanda. So I also learned just recently something that I was a little bit horrified by, and that is some of the designers of the apps that we use on our phones, for those of you who have smartphones and are using them, they some of them, not all of them, some of the companies work with the people who also are designing slot machines, because they are knowing, they're like, what is addictive? What helps people stay addicted? It's not because they're nefarious necessarily, but they get more advertising dollars, right, the longer you stay on that particular screen. So they're purposefully designed to make you want to come back and stay. So it can take some real resolve, some determination to not be pushed around by what other people are trying to make us do, right? It kind of requires us to have to stand up, maybe have some equanimity and some clarity about what's really happening here. And maybe, as Ulana said too, to kind of have a motivation, some clarity about what direction we want to go. So at the end of the day, when we look at how we spent our time, you know, it's in alignment with what's most important to us, as opposed to succumbing to being pushed around by others or apps for those of us who have our phones with us all the time. So some of you talked about accountability. So you could think about resolve as kind of like setting an inner expectation that you're going to do something. And in the Buddhist teachings, there is this word expectation or accountability. We don't really find it in there. But we do know that in terms of like behavior, the Buddha was teaching about a little bit about accountability. And in one way is this direction on instructions of how you know what to do, like everything. When I say what to do, like every single action. And this is a quote from when the Buddha was teaching his son, when the son was young. I'm not sure. I think I think his son was like 7 years old at this time. That may not be right. I'm not sure. But so here's a quote of what the Buddha is speaking to his son. His son's name is Rahula. Rahula, when you reflect, if you know this action that I did led to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both, it was an unwholesome action with painful consequences, with painful results, then you should speak of such action. You should reveal it, lay it open to the teacher or to your wise companions. Having confessed it, revealed it, laid it open, you should undertake restraint for the future. So the Buddha is pointing out, you know, we are responsible for our actions and we should reflect on them, the consequences and what impact they may have. But if we discover that we've gone off a little off course, part of what's coming back and make it a little bit stronger so that we can stay back is to share it with others, to not hide it, to not, you know, add shame on top of it. And he says to share it to your teacher or the wise companion, right? So we can think about what this means for us in our lives. Who is a wise companion? Do we have a teacher? Maybe, I don't know, I'm just making this up. Maybe it is posting on Facebook, yikes, I just did this terrible thing and I feel awful. Maybe that's, I don't know. But we can find a way for ourselves. Like when we find that we have erred and gone off a little track, it can help us to be accountable if we are talking about it. In the same way, many of you may be familiar of this, the Kalama Sutta, where the Buddha talks to the group of individuals who... they live in this town where there's all these spiritual teachers coming through. And this was true in the ancient India at the time. There's a lot of competing philosophies and a lot of competing religions. They may have not been full-blown religions yet at that time. It's not surprising. Each one would arrive in town and say, I have the truth here. I have the true doctrine. You know, don't listen to everybody else. So these poor people, the Kalamas, are getting kind of confused. Like, but wait, you know. Person A said this, and person B said the opposite of person A. Right? This is probably not anything new that we haven't experienced ourselves. So this is the Buddha's instructions to the Kalamas, like how to work with this, like how to know. Well, like when you hear all these competing ideas, how to know what to do. And yeah, so he says, when Kalamas, you know for yourselves these things are unwholesome, these things are blameworthy, these things are censored by the wise, these things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. So these things that are censored by the wise, right? So what those people that are wise, that we have respect for, that are maybe leaders in our community that we have respect for, what are they saying aren't good things to do? What are other people, if we were to say to others that we were doing this, what would they say? I don't recommend you continue doing that. So in this way, we can learn from what other people are saying that we have respect for. And maybe if we are saying, if we are sharing those difficulties that we are having, to think about, sorry, I'm getting this mixed up. So the first thing was about to say when we find ourselves doing something that was unwholesome or perhaps harmed somebody, then we can share it. But also we can reflect, we can consider, what would other people whom are wise, that are good friends, that we have respect for, what would they say, even if we haven't shared? What would they say if we were to tell them, maybe before we do it? So in this way, there can be some accountability about what we're doing. As opposed to, you know, keeping everything quiet, it's much easier, right, to kind of get off track if we're just not sharing or not listening to other people or not taking in some feedback. So around this idea of accountability, we can make this gross generalization and say there can be inner expectations, that is, expectations we have for ourselves, and there can be outer expectations, expectations that other people have for us. And then Gretchen Rubin, who is not a Buddhist teacher, but she teaches about habits and like how to make your life go the direction that you want. She has this thing that I think is really interesting, is to notice, are you influenced more by outer expectations or inner expectations? She says that people kind of just naturally, just like maybe a personality type, it doesn't seem to be variable, but which are you more likely to be influenced by? And she calls it these tendencies, and she has these four tendencies. The first one are those that readily will adhere to both inner and outer expectation. If there's an expectation, they're going to do it. That's just the way it is. And these type of people wake up and think, oh, what's on the schedule and the to-do list for today? And they get up and do it. These people turn out not to be that common. It's a little bit rare. So they respond to both outer and inner. She calls those upholders. There's a second type of people that are called questioners. These are people that question all expectations, whether they come from the outside or the inside, external or internal. They may wake up and think, what needs to be done today and why? And then they only do those things that make sense to them. So in some ways, they're converting their external expectations, they kind of convert them to interior expectations, things that they can adopt and believe in. So these are the questioners. The third category are obligers. Those people that respond readily to outer expectations, but not so much to their inner expectations. They may meet their commitments to others, but not so much to themselves. They find it more difficult to do this. They may wake up and think, what must I do today? You know, this feeling of, you know, having to satisfy all these outer expectations, but not taking care of themselves in a way that they can do inner expectations. And then the fourth is, she calls rebels. People don't want to have anything to do with any expectations. They don't care if it's external or internal. They wake up and think, what do I want to do today? And they often do what they want to do, independent of their expectations. And they resist control of any type, whether even self-control. And they may frustrate others and frustrate themselves and may find it difficult to meet any kind of commitments. But they place a high value on authenticity and self-determination. So we have upholders who meet external and internal expectations. Questioners who in some way kind of convert external to internal expectations and then meet those internal ones. We have obligers who can meet external but aren't so good at meeting internal expectations. And then fourth are rebels, those who aren't very good at meeting either external or internal. So I offer this as a way, if you can recognize yourself as one of these four, then you can just work with that as a way to help you with your resolve. Kind of some of these Buddhist teachings rely a lot on internal expectations, you know, that you set the resolve that you're going to meditate daily, you're going to really work with the precepts, you're going to go on retreat or whatever it is. But that may not be your tendency. That may not be what comes easiest to you. That may not become what's natural to you. So you can ask, is there a way that you can build in some external accountability into your life? If you're one of those people, that it would benefit you. If it would benefit you, you could do that. And what are those ways in which you can do external accountability? Many of you have been talking about it here. Community, right? Could share some aspiration, some resolve that you have. You can share it with somebody. Not only your difficulties, but say, you know, I'm going to meditate every morning for at least 10 minutes for the next week, and I'm going to email you next week and let you know how I did. I just offer this up as an idea, as something that we can use as a support. Right? Kind of part of the Buddhist practice is certainly like about knowing ourselves. And maybe if we know how our relationship is to expectations and accountability can really support us. Not that we have to be different, but that we can just use it as a way to support our intentions, aspirations, and resolves. Are there any comments or questions? Rob, yes. So it's Gretchen Rubin, and she has this book. It's called Better Than Before. And I'm really enjoyed reading it. I can just say that. And I learned a lot. And I actually started taking better care of myself and having better habits. So it influenced me, for whatever that's worth. Anybody else have some questions? Yes, Morgan. Yeah, this is the way that I understand it, is that they think they have to be true to themselves in that moment. So, like, that's authentic. It's like, in this moment, I feel like doing X. And it doesn't really matter what the expectations are. In that moment, they have this feeling, and they want to honor that feeling that they have. Does that make sense? Oh, yes, sorry. I'm not sure where there's a mic. So for those of us listening, Morgan just asked me about how is a rebel being motivated by authenticity.
Okay, so they are motivated by what they feel in the moment, which may or may not be connected to inner self, is more ego, do you think? Or, I don't know.
I don't know. Do you have an idea?
I'm thinking I have in my past been a rebel, and that what I wanted to do in the moment, I justified by being, I'm just being me. But now from this vantage point, the me who I was a construct and conditioned, and having 60s parents, and they were rebels, and let's go get arrested and marched against nuclear war kind of thing, which some of it was great, it was lined up, but some of it was like, meh, I'm going to go do this because I want to, and I'm self-actualized, but wasn't really legit. I don't know. So I don't know. I guess I need to think that over some more.
Yeah, so, you know, maybe that's part of the definition of being a rebel, right? To say you don't really meet expectations. Or you're just like, psh, those are other people's problems, not mine.
Well, I have a question about questionnaire.
Uh-huh.
Does that mean that a questionnaire is someone who integrates the external to the internal? So he or she is not a rebel, but more of a whatever is necessary to be done, right? That type of things.
They want things to make sense. And they're going to put mm-hmm. their effort towards things that really make sense.
Because that's what I'm kind of identifying myself with.
Yeah, so they are just asking, well, why do I have to do that? How is this beneficial? And who else is doing this? And like, where does it fit? And they mm-hmm. And then once they get the answers, and if it makes sense, then they adopt it.
Right, because I'm getting a little bit confused between the questionnaire and the obliger. Because I am coming from the obliger to the questionnaire. That's what's happening. That's what was and is happening. It's more authentic, actually, to be a questionnaire. Because
it's more
authentic.
I would say these are all authentic. These are all different ways of how we kind of show up. But we come to these tendencies through our conditioning, our life experience, and right, we may have some deep-rooted ideas, right? I mean, it could be authentic. I don't know. I shouldn't say what is...
Okay. Obliger didn't feel authentic to me until I start questioning and become a questionnaire.
Yeah, so a questioner more wants it to make sense, and an obliger will do it just because they said they would do
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Even if it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Okay.
But they're being authentic in the sense that they said they would do it.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so it's 12:33. Let's break for lunch. And how about if we come back at 1:45? Okay. Thank you.